Hi everybody, thanks Ricky for chairing the meeting. Can you hear me okay? Yes, you can. I just want to thank Matt first of all for asking us to do this, and thank all the committee for putting this on. Seems a bit strange, rather than a usual meeting. It reminds me a bit of being in prison when you get a close visit. Most of my visits were like this, you know, because basically the drugs were, you know, something that was in my life quite a lot. But I'll try and qualify myself as much as I can. I just want to thank all the other speakers and they were fantastic, and I really identified with them all, and they inspired me so much. Anyway, I'll kind of start off. As you say, I'm in Thailand, and I'm here until August. I was meant to be home about a month ago, but it's just the way the world is. I've ended up here, and I'll be here till then. And I'm originally from Glasgow, and I'm in the Fellowship of Cocaine Anonymous in Glasgow. And as you know, I was brought up in the East End of Glasgow, which is quite rough. Grew up with a family that didn't really have basically much reward. We were poor, so we didn't really know, have much in the big family. I grew up with an alcoholic father, who was violent and abusive, and he bullied me as a child. He was an alcoholic. I actually preferred him when he was on the drink, rather than his off the drink, because what would usually happen is he'd be violent to my mum. When he came home, and my mum would leave the house and go to her parents' and he'd leave me with him. And when he didn't have a drink, he was aggressive, and he bullied me. But in amongst this, my mother, siblings, and mother did they know about this, and he used to warn me if they found out, there would be trouble. So he was quite a bully. And I felt, they talk about, he was alcoholic, they talk about alcohol comes in bottles and alcoholism comes in people. You know, and my house was rife with alcoholism. You know, it was absolutely rife. And my wee mother was one of these mothers who was she was a wee Christian woman who just wanted her family to do the normal kind of a things. And she would have things like, even though we didn't have a dining room, she'd put a dining table in the living room and try and get us all to sit at it, like a family, eat dinner. But nobody sat at it because of this alcoholism. You know, we all sat in different rooms. Only time we came out of the room was when we were getting fed or we wanted to have somebody. We just couldn't communicate, and anybody communicating in the house was just aggressive and doing each other's throat. And my father could control me with facial expressions. He could move me from one end of the room to another, you know, without anybody else on. It was a bit like Morse code. But even before I took drugs, I used to concentrate about killing myself. I felt the separation and the isolation that I felt running about my family. I didn't feel part of it, and I feel they didn't want me. And I used to, the most selfish thing, and I didn't want to die. A wee boy, a young boy, 8 or 9 year old, putting belts on his neck and hoping that they would come in and see me and try and understand how I felt and that look that they're making. It was so selfish, pure self-centeredness. Look, I wanted them to come in and say, look what yous are making me do, you know. And what's involved in that, when I started, I found solvents, and solvents were just something that took me right out of my heat. It took me right out of my reality. And in that thing, when I started sniffing glue and taking different solvents, I spent most of my time not wanting to go home. So my father spent most of his time looking for me. And when I got home, he would strip me and all the clothes off me, cold bath, belt, every night. That was every night I got
cold bath and a belt.
You'd probably be the day you would get you'd probably get to jail
for it the day, wouldn't
you? Be child abuse. You would call my father a child abuser. If that was happening today, But that was a daily occurrence. So this man, I can't stand him, and I was terrified. But I'm going to try and qualify myself as quick as I can, because it's been a long time since I've kind of hounded in drugs. It's about 25 years since it's... So I quickly went for solvents into smoking cannabis, taking opiates, and then taking cocaine and going to the nightclub scene and liked my fashion, liked the clothes, wanted the money, wanted the cars, try to achieve all that stuff. And that's what I did. I set out and done all that stuff, and then the end result, I think we all know the end result. What happens to most is I've never seen a successful drug addict. You know, it ends up people spend a lot of time in prisons, or they end up in treatment centres, and basically what happened is I ended up, my end result was I was injecting heroin and cocaine on a daily basis, and on a methadone prescription, and that went on for many years. And like some people saying that they could stop, I couldn't stop. I couldn't get one day, I couldn't get one hour, I couldn't. I've got 86 previous convictions, and that's not because that's not what makes me an addict. That just makes me a thieving bastard that get caught all the time. I just didn't like being in main skin, and the first thing in the morning my eyes would open up, I would just head into the streets, and it was all just about carnage, crime. I had a big family, and we were all the same. 90% of my family, my dad had 8 brothers and 5 sisters, and my mum had another big family. So this housing scheme in Glasgow, we actually controlled the whole housing scheme because of the size of the family. So we just run them up. We run them up. And then amongst this, you know, by this time, I'm spending a lot of times in prisons. And in prisons, would be things that I was taught about. I still could never, when I got arrested, I was still couldn't stop thinking about drugs. It was all about getting doctors. How can I get another prescription? Who's getting a visit? All that kind of stuff. So, I think you get the idea of. But what basically happened is, as well, you know, when you're living that lifestyle, you don't get up in the morning thinking about I need to brush my teeth, or I need to brush my hair, or I need to make sure I've got clean socks or clean underwear. That didn't come into equation. So I was absolutely fucking manky.
No.
I was bogging. I was stoking about Glasgow city centre, just staying in basically homeless guys' houses, just squatting in their houses where they were getting supported accommodation, because I didn't want to go to the services that provide people with homeless scattered flats. So I thought it was better just to wheel your way into their houses and stay them and think I was better. Do you know what I mean? So basically, come to Fellowship. I came to Fellowship because my mum and my dad, they went to Alcoholics Anonymous. But this time, my dad's no drinking. My dad's going to Alcoholics Anonymous. And basically, they're encouraging me to go to meetings. And there were no Cocaine Anonymous in Scotland. So it was a mixture of
the two other fellowships, you know.
And I went to the other fellowship, and every night, I went to the fellowship, and see in amongst all that carnage, you know, I've been slashed, I've been stabbed, I got shot there in the leg, all this today with different drugs and drug deals and things that didn't go right, and you know, it didn't, and overdosed, and it beatings off my family, detoxes, rehabs, nothing was stopping me, you know. And when prescription drugs for me was my goal was just to get to stick on methadone and a few temazepams, and far as I was concerned, that was me getting clean. So that was my goal, you know, that was my goal at first. But like I say, I came into meetings, and I always remember there were only 3 the other fellowship meetings in Glasgow, and I used to go to the Freedom, And when I used to go to the meetings, I'd be absolutely bawling. You know, the people would be following me about the meetings. You know, I would be trying people's jackets up, putting coffees in my sleeve. People would come and take it back after me. And back then, when I first came to meetings, I went to meetings for 2 years and I couldn't get clean. Could not for the life of me get clean. And back then, there were 3 or 4 people that just went to these meetings. And back then, I can always remember that the chair spoke for an hour. The chairperson maybe done about 15 or 20 minutes and never really was in the meeting. Got to talking on. They were maybe talking about fellowships, talking about 12 steps, because they were maybe even through the 12 steps. And they were maybe talking about God. They would be talking about things like the road less travelled, books they read, and how they were going to get an education, or they've done this personal PT and things like that. So nobody ever spoke about that. It was all about kind of a personal development rather than some kind of spiritual development. So basically, when I came to meetings, they used to tell you in the meetings back in Glasgow, I don't know if they do it then, if you're views today, it'd be best you don't speak because you might say something that you might regret and not come back. So basically, I would get into these meetings because my mum and my father was quite, I didn't really talk to my father still. They were quite excited the fact that, you know, excited the fact that I was going to meetings. So I would go back and tell them what had happened in the meetings, and I'd be saying to them in the meetings, they're not letting me talk. They're not letting me talk. They're just telling me to sit down and shut up and listen. So I resented the fact out of them. And some of the guys were quite aggressive when they'd done it. They're like, well, listen, mate, you need to shut up. You can't talk if you use today. And I'd say, no, I've no. And I'd got it down to maybe using 90 mil of methadone a day. And that was me, as far as I was saying, I thought it was clean, but these guys were talking about total abstinence, and I couldn't get my head on it. So I became a pest. I became one, you've all seen them in the meeting, you know what I mean? One of the pests, you know what I mean? And I'd stole things like a woman's purse at the meeting. You know, I just became a pure, pure pest. And you know what? There's lots and lots of different things that I did, and you know, they never told me not to come back. But what did happen, I can always remember, as much as all these people were aggressive to me, the other guys, these two other wee women, and they were originally went to Alcoholics Anonymous, and they were in a group. There were 3 groups in this, NA groups, and they were in one on a Monday night. And I went down to this meeting one day, and they were always, you could tell these two women were listening to me. I remember they caught me stealing 4 jars of coffee at the meeting as well. And they came back and woke me and they're like, what you got? Where you going, Eddie? What have you got and all that? And I'm like, nothing. And they've searched me. And they only took 2 of me and kept me to keep the other 2. they were just, I don't know, the love that they were showing me was unbelievable. But what I'm trying to say is, you know, this illness that we've got is about the separation and the isolation, and which I didn't feel part of anything. But what I'm trying to say is the aggression that had happened to me, and because some people were fed up with me, and they just thought, that boy doesn't want half drugs, he just come here like a youth club, you know. And but you don't come to a meeting every night for 2 years and no want half drugs. I had that desire. So basically, one time when I walked into this meeting, that these two wee women, I says to them, who's doing the chair tonight? And they went, you're doing it. I says, I can't do it, because all these ones have been a bit longer than me. These ones have been a bit longer than me would have walked out the door, I thought. And I says, Anne-Marie, I can't share. She's like, why? I says, I'm still on my methadone. She says, well, we don't care. Us two are group members and our group's autonomous, and we're deciding we want to hear your story tonight. So I thought they were kidding on. I was that excited and that nervous that I couldn't even tell my own story. I ended up telling all their stories, the ones that was coming in, because I still had this feeling I want to fit in, you know. And so anyway, for the first time in 2 years, I came out of that meeting high as a kite. I felt part of something. These two wee women had made me feel part of something. They showed me a bit of love. And that had never happened to me in 2 years. I'd been police phoned for me because I took a laptop at the convention. I went away with that. I'd been charged for different things, but what I'd experienced after these two wee women was love, and I didn't know how to deal with it. And see, that next day, I met up with that wee woman, and I put down my methadone, and I got a day clean. And that was on the Tuesday afternoon, and I went to a meeting on the Tuesday night, and I put it down and went through the rattles. And after that, you know, it was all, what I was trying to say is about, that was the first bit of, where somebody inspired me, was these two people. And these two people who understood what the problem was, how about powerlessness, what it is about the separation and the isolation, and how we feel no part of nothing, and how we don't, you know, how this illness doesn't want us to have family members, it doesn't want us to be part of CA, it doesn't want to be part of anything, it doesn't want us to be part of God, it doesn't want to be part of it. But these two women could see by all that. No, it's your other fellowship guys are just telling me, sit down there and shut up and don't cause any problem. Just Eddie, don't just sit there. And they were aggressive to me. That wasn't working because I had that. I hadn't. But these wee women had noticed that I needed to feel part of something. They understood what the problem was. So what I'm trying to say, the power of love was so much powerful for me to put down the drugs than the power of, you know, being locked up in prisons and locked up in rehabs and locked up. This something that happened to me and it took a wee shine to me. And that was over 25 years ago, you know. And like I say, I came to fellowship. I got involved in after that 12-step program. I couldn't read, I couldn't write. I was a bit like Jane, so I thought I'd no chance of being able to do this because I'd no education. I'd been using since I was 13, and I was into my 20s. And I hadn't attended school. Most of my schools are proof schools and prisons and different things like that. So I was frightened of the 12 steps. But I met this other man who was dyslexic, and he had never been through the program either. And then he had been helping somebody else, and this other guy was a school teacher. So the three sat down and said, I think we're going to do. And they brought this guy in, and he read the book, and we went through the book. And it was Alcoholics Anonymous book. And by this time, CA hadn't started in Scotland yet. And I was at the first, me and Remy used to go to Narcotics Anonymous. And that's where we went to first. That's the reality, and I can't change it. And we had the first CA meeting in one of my friends' house in Scotland, Richard. And that's what it was all born. And most of my time since then is spent serving the Cocaine Anonymous in Scotland. And that's what I do. But what I want to share about is the fantastic experience, the power of love and the power of forgiveness that this program's done for me. I was talking about my dad there. My dad, I absolutely hated him. Once I go up to the amends list, and I don't want to go through all the program, I want to talk about what God's done in my life to transform the hatred I had for this man and the love that, you know, because this man he hadn't drunk for about 15 years. And I was used to go home to my family house, and I'd sit in the house and try and sit with my parents, and he'd get up and sit in the room because we couldn't talk because we had that much resentment in each other. And I would get into the house, and it's as if I still had all this anger with all the doings and everything he gave me. And it's still that I would look at him when I was a young boy, he used to batter the life at me, and he'd have this big beard, and I was terrified of him. And seeing he hadn't hurt me since I was a teenager. Seeing I'd get into his house, I'd still see all this horrible face, and I used to think, I'd love to punch. Oh, wait, sorry for the language. I'd love to punch that all over the place. And I was full of anger, and he was full of resentment at me, because I would sit at his dining table, come into his house, and I'd sit like that in my heat, hanging in bowls of soup, and I would ask him for fags, and he would launch it to me like a spear. Do you know what I mean? You see, spend less money on drugs and buy fags, and he would get up and sit in the bedroom until I went away, and I had to leave, and it was causing all sorts of conflict with my mother, and because my mother would just always be there for me, you know. And But as I get into recovery, this man was he was on my men's list. And all the other men's list I could do absolutely fine. I had my mother, I could never go in all the shops, you know, and make amends to all the people with the violence. I could have never, because I couldn't remember them all. Most of my amends took was indirect amends, because I was involved in East End of Glasgow opening loads and loads and loads and loads of meetings, you know, just constantly and helping others and serving things. But what I want to talk about was, because my sponsor says to me, we want to deal with the main ones, the most important ones was the family. And when I had this, my father on it, so his men's was to go and make amends to him. And every time I'd go back to the house to try and make amends, I tried to talk to him. And all it was about was talk to him about what he did to me. And, you know, obviously I wanted to acknowledge that, because I don't want to carry that on to my children and think that's acceptable to give your boy a cold bath in the belt and batter him like an adult when you feel like you want to batter him and bully him. You know, so I wanted to acknowledge that him and let him know that, you know, it's not acceptable, but I forgive him and things like that. But he used to just say things like, he used to just say things like, you know, Eddie, grow up and put it in the past. It's in the past, you know, and that. And I went back to my sponsor, and my sponsor says, maybe you should leave this for a while and try and put the stuff aside about what he's did to you and try and, you know, look at what you, why he was doing this to you and own up with that. So basically, he says, why don't we pray about it and then we'll write him a letter? I says, a letter's not going to do nothing, you know, and he says, we'll pray for God to make the appointment and then you'll get this feeling when you know when it's right. So he says, we'll write a letter first, and we wrote the letter. You've probably heard a lot of people writing about it. And when I wrote about the letter, it was, dear Dad, if I had a son like me, I would have appreciated him more. I'd have came, played and played football and blah, de, blah, de, blah. And at the end of it, I just broke down and cried. And I got this feeling of, I just want my daddy. And that's what came out of that whole thing. All this whole thing about growing up was, I just wanted the love that my dad, from my acceptance from my father, but he couldn't do. But he was an alcoholic. Even if he was giving me, probably the condition that I've got, I would have never felt it. Because the illness about the separation and isolation, it was all, this illness had me so wrapped up in myself and so, you know, disconnected from my family and to God, you know. So basically, I'd said the prayer, I'd wrote the letter, and I'd let God do the rest. And I remember sitting, my dad's one of the chief supervisors at Celtic Park, and he works there, and he's worked there for a long time, and he used to get all our friends and that into the football. And I remember watching him, and my pal says to him, there's your dad there. And I looked at him, and I looked at him in a different way, and I get this voice in my head saying, you love him so much. And I went, where the hell is this coming from? You know, and what I thought, first thing I thought about, this is a spiritual experience you're having here. This is a change of thinking. You know, so he's walking towards me, and I've looked at his face, and I could see his face as if he was totally transformed. The look in his face, and I says to him, have you had a shave? He says, no, but he used to have a full beard. He says, I've had this wee goatee for about 16 years. I says, you look dead different. And he's like, what are you talking about? He says, if you get a lift home, I'll give you a lift home. And I knew this was the time. I just knew the timing was right, you know. And what had happened to me, I'd swallowed a big painkiller, you know, forgive that man for what he did. And what I'm trying to say is resentment had me looking at him as if he was giving me cold baths and belts for 20 years. And the man wasn't he? The man was an absolutely lovely man who served AA and served loads of people, you know, but resentment had affected my relationship with my father. I have never touched my father. The only time my father's ever put his hands on me is when he's giving me belts and doings or getting up. I thought to my dad, he's never shown me any love in his life. But see, the more I looked at it, and when I got rid of all that resentment, my dad was in every jail in Scotland up visiting me. He was in every back. I didn't worry about sentences I was getting. I used to be worried about my dad sitting in the back of the court shaking his head. And he'd travel to maybe 3-4 hours away to different courts just to sit for 5 minutes to hear me getting sentenced. And that would happen on every occasion. So see, when the forgiveness came, I could see the love in the man's actions, but he was incapable of showing me it. So the forgiveness started happening, knowing, fast forward that, you know, my dad's giving me a run home that day anyway, and he says to me, I need to talk to you. And he's like, what do you want to talk to us about? He says, I need to talk to you about, you know, I really want to let you know that I'm sorry for the way I treated you and your mother when you were growing up. He says, and he started sharing a wee bit about what it was like for him growing up. He started talking about how he got sexually abused in a children's home. And then he started talking about how his father got murdered in front of him on Christmas Day, and he was left to bring up, he was the oldest, he was left to bring up 8 brothers and 4 sisters. And he felt that he was the father of the house, and he treated me the same, because that's what he did to every one of his brothers and sisters, belts, cold bath, you know, and he did that same thing to me. So what I'd realised about all I wanted from my dad was the love and acceptance of him. And my father was always there with his love and affection, there with things, even though he never physically touched me and cuddled me or told me he loved me. You know, the actions were telling something else, but I could see this now and see the stuff that I had that just shrunk. It shrunk. And what happened is, when I'd done that inventory and I'd done that amends to him, I could realise that, you know, I just seen my dad as another alcoholic, same as myself. He'd do all the same stuff as me. And me and my dad didn't, you know, become, you know, best mates and do things, both fishing. You know, we started talking to each other like another alcoholic. We'd see each other in a meeting and we'd talk.
We'd talk about
football, we'd talk about, you know, different things. We never talked, we grunted at each other. So what had happened is, after that, quickly, weeks after that, my dad ended up in hospital. And he ended up, it's probably a week ago or something like his anniversary. And this, I've been told that he's in the hospital, and I've turned up at the hospital, and he's got hospital pneumonia. And I go there, and all his brothers and sisters are all at his bedside, and they're all fucking rigid. They've got all the same feelings as me, but I've no dealt with it, and I've no forgiven them. So I've walked around to the hospital, and the first thing, I took a deep breath, and I says, God, give me a horn here. And I get this voice in my head telling me, Eddie, you better get there and make amends to this man, or you're going to need to go and date in one of these amends trees. So get your arse in gear and go and tell this man how fantastic a job he's did. So I've never touched this man. I've never cuddled him. I've never kissed him. So that's very strange for a man and a woman, a father and a son. Me and my boys sit and cuddle and tell each other we love each other every day. we were FaceTime, we cuddle each other. I'd never had this, and this was only 5 years ago, 6 years ago. You know, and all that time, and I lived with a man. I lived with him. But anyway, I've been there and I've sat with him and I've started stroking his head and I've started saying, John, you're going to be all right. And it's all that, his brothers and sisters got that uneasy for what I was doing. I think they thought I was having sex with him. You know, they all started leaving the room. You know, they're all going, what's happening here? Because they're that rigid with this illness as well. So anyway, cut a long story short, weeks have gone by and I've been up that hospital every day and I've watched that man, you know, take his last breath, you know. And I remember the night before when he's ran at his oxygen levels and all that. It's a bit like the symptoms he had, the same as you would get with that coronavirus. All that was happening, his lungs were filling up and things like that. So they took it after, you know, the night before. I always remember me and him sat and we watched a movie together and it was that Passion of Christ. So we're sat and I'm in the bedroom and the nurse's like, you need to get out the bed. You know, if a guy could have touched him, I'm lying in bed telling him how fantastic a job he's done, the first person to go and get sober and be a fantastic example. And as a result of that, some of his brothers are sober and you should be really proud and things like that. And, you know, and this man started telling me he was scared. You know, and I says, what are you scared about? He's scared. He says, I'm scared I'm not going to get into heaven. He's like, what do you mean? I says, He says, well, you've treated you and your mother and everybody else. And I says, oh, wait a minute. I says, we can get right here, right now. We can get right with God. And he's like, what do you mean? He says, right here, we can pray at this present time. And what had happened is, and I says to him, you know, remember that movie we watched the other night? I says, I'm going to let you know it wasn't a saint or a rabbi or a minister that joined Jesus in heaven first. It was a murderer and a thief. And his wee face lit up. And I said, Mum, we'll pray. And the two of us prayed, and my sister came in, and we prayed together. And about an hour later, we hoarded his horn, and he took his last breath. He took his last breath and he just started praying, and the three prayed together. And what I'm trying to say is, if I didn't have this program and this fellowship, I wouldn't have had that experience. I wouldn't have had, because this illness doesn't want us to have relationships with anybody. It doesn't want me to have a relationship with any of yous. It doesn't want me to have relationships with my family. And most of all, it doesn't want us to have a connection with this power and the gods in the life. And that's what I've got in my life. Now, I can talk about, you know, if I could show you a photograph, like, I'd look absolutely pathetic, you know, what I looked like when I first came here, but it's not really about that. I can tell you about all the properties I've got, all the places, the business I've got. It's absolutely not about that. It isn't that at all. What it's about is about the relationship that I've got with God in my life and this power. And the most beautiful thing that I've got today, you know, is, you know, that man, you know, see, if that was back then when I was using it, it would all been about me. You know, it would have been all about me saying my dad's dying, what am I going to do, and if anybody spoke to me. But I've always been able to walk through that experience with a wee bit of dignity and respect. And I had a fantastic experience with him. And the both of us and my sister had a fantastic experience. And that's what happens. You know, recovery for me is about stuff like that. It's about relationships. Because if I've not got a relationship with God, usually when I've not got God in my life, then there's usually, I get into a state of powerlessness where you all start irritating the life at me. You know, my family start irritating the life at me. People irritate the life at me. Everywhere. And I just become restless, irritable, and discontent. And that's all. If I'm disconnected to God, I'm not connected to you people. So my main purpose is to stay connected to God, and that's what the 12-step program for. That's what the book is. That's what the book. I don't like coming in and start interpreting it on, because I know it inside out. But I've been through this different phases in recovery where I've been the guys that's banging the drum and telling you need to do this program, or you are going to die. Or I've been the guy that's been chasing education, businesses, success, you know, physical appearances. I've been all the guys, and the guys that's talking about the steps, I'd be saying, you ought to get a fucking job, you cunt, that's all you do is go to meetings. Or I'd be the guy who's on the steps saying, you ought to start helping people, you know, concentrating that, that's why the state you're in. You know, I've been all the guys, and it's nice just to be me. And it isn't important what anybody else is saying. It isn't important. All I can do is what the wee woman that did for me, is to try and inspire somebody and love them enough so that they want to do it. Because aggression and all that stuff will not work for me. Fear will not work for me, because the first thing somebody told me that somebody died with drugs, the first thing a normal person would think, I'm staying away from that. I don't think like that. I think, where did they get that? I'm going to try half of that and then try half of now. Anyway, so for me, the 12-step program is a vehicle to take you to God and have that power in your life. You know, sorry, guys. I think that's a cue for me to be quiet anyway. So I'm not going to say much more. I think that was a God job cutting me off there. Sometimes you just say enough. So I'm not going to say much more. And I really thank everybody for the committee and all the way to Thailand. And, you know, my living the dream for me is waking up in the morning and wondering what I'm going to have for my breakfast. Is it going to be porridge or is it going to be a bit of toast? Because I didn't have that. I got up in the morning and you opened your eyes and it says, you better get down to that chemist, get what you need to get, and then go and score a bit of crack or a bit of coke. So for me, that's a dream. The obsession has left me, you know, and that's what I get on a daily basis. So I really thank you all, and I'm looking forward to the rest of the convention thing. Thanks very much. Glad to be included.